Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Hello. My name is Natalie Turvey, and I run the Canadian Journalism Foundation. And on behalf of the CJF, welcome to our first J Talk of 2020. We are kicking off the season with some optimism and a rare bright spot in the news industry, the podcast promise. If you'd like to join tonight's conversation on Twitter, you can do that using the hashtag CJFJTalk or Everyone Has a Podcast. I'd like to thank those who make our events possible. BMO Financial Group is our JTalk series sponsor, our thanks to Cision, our in-kind supporter, and our gratitude for TD for bringing us another bright spot. TD hosts journalism students from high school and from J-school programs at our event tonight and at all of our CJF events throughout the year. And do we have any students tonight? Can we see you? Can we see any of the students? I see a few hands at the back. Well, podcasts came on the scene around the time this group was born, and today we are in the midst of a podcast explosion. There's an International Podcast Day. There are festivals, conferences, clubs, books about podcasting, a whole podcabulary, and an exhaustive list of podcasts about podcasting. According to our latest research in Canada, nearly 11 million Canadian adults have listened to a podcast in the past year. And where the audience goes, the money usually follows. Big companies are paying attention to this space, and podcasting revenue in Canada is poised for some steep growth. This year, ad revenue from podcasting is estimated to exceed $60 million, according to a recent report by the CRTC. But not everyone can be the next Joe Rogan. Love him or hate him, he made $30 million last year from his podcast. So how can the average Joe be successful in this space? Well, tonight we're going to hear from some expert interviewers and master storytellers who will share their experiences launching a podcast in Canada and the challenges of creating compelling audio narratives that draw audiences. Our moderator is one of them. Alamin Abdelmahmoud is news curation editor with BuzzFeed News. He also co-hosts a podcast, Party Lines, with CBC Podcasts. He's a columnist for CBC Radio and a frequent culture and politics commentator. You might have come across his work in the Globe and Mail, Maclean's Magazine in Chatelaine. You are in great hands this evening. Please join me in a round of applause for our moderator and our speaker tonight.
Hi, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited about this, but now this conversation is just going to be about why Joe Rogan's making so much money. There's very few things that make me as upset as that piece of information, Natalie. Thank you so much for everyone for joining us on stage. You often hear the phrase, our guests need no introduction. They really don't, so I'm not going to introduce them at all. You can read it in the program. These are legends of the podcasting space. I guess I want to get started by diving into it right away with the veteran of the space on stage. That's Vicky. You've been around podcasting for 6 years. That's longer than me. That's longer than most of us here on stage. Can you tell us what drew you to podcasting?
I don't know that I was drawn to podcasting so much as I was tagged into podcasting, which is that I started at Canada Land, and it was right about when Andre and Desmond stepped off of Canada Land Commons, and I was hanging around trying to take as much of Jesse Brown's money as I could, and he needed a host, and I was sitting there, and so he tagged me in to do Canada Land Commons with Supriya Dwivedi, and I really, really loved it. You know, I love Canadian politics, and that was a show about trying to make it accessible and trying to make it interesting and recognizing that most people don't truly care about the minutiae of the House of Commons but mm-hmm. do want to know about what's happening in the country. And so that's what we got to do on that show, and that's what drew me in, which was that you could take your time to tell stories, you could reflect on things, and it's a nice way to be able to both step off of the news cycle, but still participate fully in it mm-hmm. and tell stories or find ways to tell stories that are new and interesting. One of my favorite episodes that we ever did was talking to migrant workers about their experience as migrant workers and their voices that I had never heard, stories I'd never heard before, and that we could spend time to tell that story was, I think, to me, refreshing, and I think it also gave me a ton of power, which I loved, in that I got to figure out what stories were worth telling, and they weren't dictated by the rest of the industry and how it flowed. It was totally based on our small team deciding what mattered and wanting to go forward with that. So that's, you know, 6 years ago, and since then I've gotten to do some version of that in different ways and in different shows.
The attraction of the medium in some ways is that ability to take the time that you need to tell that story. Connie, when you launched Missing and Murdered in 2016, that could have been a documentary, a TV documentary, that could have been an episode of The Fifth Estate, several episodes of The Fifth Estate. You chose podcasting. Why is that?
Well, I don't think that we had necessarily an opportunity to do several episodes of The Fifth Estate at that time. But it was really in the same way born out of doing stories in other ways and being dictated to by traditional platforms. We did a documentary. The podcast was kind of maybe our third kind of platform in the investigations that we were doing about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. We had done news stories. We did a database that was investigative. And we did a TV documentary for The National on one case in particular, a 15-year-old girl named Leah Anderson, who was killed in God's Lake Narrows in northern Manitoba. And my producer, Marnie Luke, and our senior producer, Heather Evans, and I had kind of done all of this reporting on this one issue and always felt like we couldn't explore the bigger context because of those limitations. Because even though we had 15 minutes on The National, which was amazing, and you know, we were grateful to get it, and you probably wouldn't get that now, we still couldn't really talk about the entire story in its entirety. We couldn't really dive deep in the way that I think is so important, especially when you're talking about Indigenous issues, that the context is the most important thing. And so we really need to, you know, we had 15 minutes on The National, but we couldn't really talk about, you know, her history in the child welfare system. We couldn't really talk about the fact that she lived in a community that didn't have access to basic services like running water and sewer, and how that impacts life in the community and, you know, affects Leah and her family and contributes to the bigger issue of MMIW. And I listened to Serial, like, maybe 2 weeks before we went up to God's Lake Narrows. Mm-hmm. And when we were up there and everything that was happening, I was like, we should be doing a podcast. And at that time, we couldn't convince them. But the next time we had a really compelling story, I feel like we kind of tricked CBC into letting us do a podcast, actually, where we pitched like a digital podcast and website, and they were really excited about the web component of it. Mm-hmm. And we were really excited about the podcast component of it. And so I think that once we, you know, show that there was an audience for it and it was a really effective way to do the journalism that everyone wanted to do, then they let us do a second season.
Now you did a documentary, you did a radio documentary as well, did the piece in The National. Why do you think the medium of the podcasting kind of took that story to the next level?
Well, I think that, like, it's the space that it gives you to fully and deeply explore a story. And let's be honest, like, I think that there are fewer and fewer places to do that in journalism today. Mm-hmm. We're fighting for seconds on social media. Like, you have to, if you post something on Facebook, it can't be longer than a minute, and people have to pay attention within the first 5 seconds or you've lost them. But there's this audience that's willing to, like, put headphones in and listen to something that's, you know, one episode is 40 minutes, 60 minutes. The entire 10 episodes is 8 hours long into one story. Mm. Like, because they appreciate that it is a complete story, like the storytelling that you're able and allowed to do in podcasting. And I think the thing that I love about it as a journalist is the transparency of it, the fact that you can be a real person. I can be Connie Walker. And talk about, like, oh God, I don't really want to knock on this person's door, but I have to. Marnie's kicking me out of the car. I've got to go. Whereas if you're on The National, you're like Connie Walker, CBC News. And there's just like a kind of, I feel like, you know, there's a disconnect.
Yeah, sure.
And with podcasting, I feel like I can reveal more of myself, and I feel like that's really appealing.
Mm. Now, David, for you, the Hurley Burley has been around since 2017, right?
Yeah.
You're not a trained journalist per se.
Obviously not.
No. But listen, so, like, this is what interests me about it. Is that, you know, like, you spend a lot of time on the dark side, if you will, whether that means sort of all various kind of hidden government relations machinery, or helping some CEOs manage some crises. I don't mean to call that the dark side, it's just that in this room it kind of might be. And so I'm curious
for
you.
I've spent my life making this world a better place.
Everyone here is very sure of that. But having said that, did you start the hurly-burly to repent?
Repent? No, Lord, I've got enough to repent for. I sure do. But no, I didn't. I started the hurly-burly for a few reasons. I started the hurly-burly because some good friends of mine came to me and suggested, probably because I have an absurdly loud laugh, that I might be a character that could appeal on a podcast.
Sure.
And I am a fading politico deep into my 50s and was looking for a second act of some, or maybe a third act of some kind. And the last thing is, I, you know, in the campaigns and the work I've done in recent years, I had become so discouraged by how superficial the discussion about politics and public policy was becoming. Mm-hmm. That I wanted to bring some more depth to that. And I wanted to bring some more sophistication to everybody who's listening, and it's not that many people, but so I have a progressive bent to me, so I've tried to use the podcast to sort of push things in that direction, but that means I've had hardcore conservatives on, so that progressives can hear that perspective. Right. And in terms of not being a trained journalist, I have another thing that I've leaned on, though, which is I've spent my life conducting focus groups in public opinion research. And when you're conducting a focus group, you're not trying to persuade anybody of something in the room. You're trying to really pull out of them everything that they think and know. And so you listen, you ask questions, and then when you listen to that question, then you ask a follow-up question to go even deeper, and you're not judgmental about the answers. And that's generally the approach that I've taken to the podcast. Sometimes people complain that I don't deal with my guests harshly enough if they say something that should be disagreed with, but I don't think that's what I'm trying to do. I think I'm trying to expose what people think, and other people can make their own judgments about that.
I think one thing that's interesting about your podcast is that oftentimes when you have your panels, for example, it often sounds to me like I'm just eavesdropping on a conversation of people who have been in this world for a very long time. It feels, in that way, it feels very much like a privilege, but also exposes just how these casual conversations go. Did you ever have a hard time convincing people like Jenny and Scott to sort of like let down their guard and talk about their secrets of the trade?
Yeah, you obviously don't know Scott Reed. so no, I didn't have any trouble convincing him to do that.
Yeah.
Jenny, I didn't know well. So Jenny's, it's just luck that, and by the way, I'm wearing this shirt that says No Goat Rodeos because I just finished having the Ontario Liberal leadership candidates on my podcast for a debate, which will be up later tonight. And during the federal election on our panel, Jenny Byrne called the federal debate a goat rodeo.
She did.
An expression I'd never heard of before, but immediately loved, and knew that I wanted this debate that we did this afternoon to be the opposite of that. So we got this shirt made of No Goat Rodeos. But Jenny is, what I wanted to, all I knew about Jenny was that she had been where Scott and I had been. And I really wanted people who'd been right at the center of things, not people who'd advised those people, not people who'd been at the periphery of them, but people who'd been right there. As Bill Fox says, people who are in the room after the meeting is over, those kind of people. And Jenny's absolutely that. And so she brought all that credential. And she was a real, she is a real conservative. I had done panels before with Jamie Watt, who's a dear friend of mine, and a very smart guy, but Jamie's kind of a liberal now, and he, you know, we'd have him on the panel, and he wouldn't agree with, wouldn't disagree
Wait,
with Scott.
By whose definition is Jamie Watt a liberal?
Pardon?
By whose definition? I mean, like, I'm no one in this room, but anyway, continue.
I bet so that's what Stephen Harper would call it. Jamie wouldn't disagree with us that much, and so one of the things I've learned about the podcast is that conflict helps. With interest, and people like to hear people clashing authentically. about that. And the second thing is, my God, people love stories. And so the fact that the three of us have no end of war stories about insider campaigns to tell, those are often the most popular parts of the episode, not when we're pronouncing with great wisdom on what's right or wrong about what's happening today, but when we tell a story about our past.
Right. Mm. No, Anna Maria, you got out. You built a house and a legacy. And
yeah,
the current,
what are you doing? Why?
And then you said, put me back in the ring. What led to that decision?
Well, I had so much freedom at the Current. You talk about freedom to cover stuff. That was the beauty of what we as a team created at the Current. We could actually tackle issues that, you know, at 8:30 in the morning that you weren't supposed to. And that was tremendous freedom. But you know what happens? You give me an inch, I want a mile, right? So so I found that very fulfilling. Mm. But the more, as I continued on, there were other stories that I wanted to tell and that I still want to tell. Mm. And it's funny, you talk about listening to Serial. Mm. And I listened to, at the point in my career when I was thinking, okay, well, how are you going to tell those other stories that you always said you wanted to work on? I hear Brian Reed talking about S-Town and how he goes to get this story that really didn't exist, but he comes back with this great tape and this great character, and he decides to treat it like a novel, and they decide to tell the story like a real serialized story. And I went, oh my God, there are other, like, you can do even more with audio than you think you can, and you can tell, you already know how to tell an audio story, but you can play around with other kinds of audio stories. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking about that. And once I started thinking about that, you know, to do the Current every day, that's your job. That is 7 days a week. That is every night. So if you want to do something else, you have to think about stepping away to do it. Mm-hmm. So that was a process because I did have that freedom. But I wanted, and the one thing I didn't want to give up was conversations, which is why I've launched more now, because it allows me to have conversations. What I'm doing behind the scenes is I'm trying to work on something serialized too. We'll see.
Right.
There's, you know, I'm back in the field with a tape recorder.
Right.
Holding my own tape recorder. Nobody, you know. But it's a very humbling thing, you know. Because I've always had a lot of help with the Current, of course. But it's that kind of thing. And I looked around and I think that podcasting, if you look at television, if you look at streaming with television, and then you look at podcasting, you realize podcasting is the shift where the listening is going, right? It's just the demographics, and I think you've got the stats, but the generation that actually owns a physical radio, is the numbers are diminishing. People listen to everything on their smartphones, and that allows them to have more choices of how to listen and everything else. And, you know, I think in some ways that, like, this is the new frontier, and it's, I love that so many people want stories in their ears, right? I love that so many people care about hearing the voices, and when you hear voices and hear stories, you see them in a different way. Like, it's just so powerful. And so it's an attempt for me to try to be part of that, and I'm not sure where it's all going. But I find it very exciting, and you know, 17 years is good at the Current, and it's good to, like, renewal matters to me too. So the Current, the best way to renew is to try something new. So,
speaking of trying something new, in your first episode, you mentioned that you're going to have to get a little more personal. You know, like that you're going to have to find maybe a different gear of talking. How has that been for you?
It's not my go-to, right? My DNA is the journalist who pulls everything out of somebody else and doesn't say, that reminds me. We were just joking about Alec Baldwin on his podcast, how no matter, you know, he always sort of says, that reminds me of something that happened. So, and sometimes that can really be great, right? So, but for me, I haven't done a lot of that. So that's a little bit of a learning curve for me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think, oh, should I just have shut up? You know, but I'm working with the team and I don't get to cut it, so.
Right.
So it's a little different for me.
Sure.
But that, and I'm learning a lot, and I think it's really great that, you know, you never, just because you've had this career for a long time doesn't mean you can't keep learning. Mm-hmm. And so I love that I'm learning from the generation coming up behind me, and that, you know, I can still work with people and they can learn from me, but I have a lot to learn from people too.
Now, I think we've only been up on stage for about 20 minutes or so, and Serial's already come up three times. And it really feels like there was a sort of a pre-serial and post-serial conversation about podcasting. Can you tell us a little bit about how you craft story, I guess, like in this sort of post-serial world? So when you started approaching the crafting of the story, the nitty-gritty of how you organized your thoughts in the story.
I think that, like, I mean, because it's a serialized podcast that I do, it's one story told over several episodes, and we really rely, or we're lucky to be able to rely on chronology. Mm-hmm. I think that that's really, because it's still journalism, it's still the truth, it's still how we approach an investigation. I think the thing that I heard from a lot of journalists after Serial was like, we do all of that, we just have never recorded it and put it out before. And right. I feel like that's essentially what we're doing. It doesn't actually change the process in that way. But in terms of crafting the story, like, you know, we rely a lot on the chronology, but I think the beauty of approaching it like a novel, approaching it like one big story, is that, like, when we did Finding Cleo, for example, we sat in a room with like a bunch of whiteboards for like the better part of a week and kind of just laid out, you know, the different threads. Like, for, I think that for, in my opinion, for a really compelling serialized podcast, there has to be a central question. The first season was, who killed Alberta Williams? The second season was Finding Cleo, like, what happened to Cleo? And that, I think, really was the driver for every episode and the overarching theme of our podcast. But what's important to me as a journalist, especially a journalist who's been trying to report on Indigenous issues in a really meaningful and robust way for a really long time, and frankly has not been always successful at doing that, that it was the context was actually the more important piece. So how were we going to show how Cleo's story and Cleo's family story was part of a bigger story about Canadian history, was part of a bigger story about the child welfare system and the overrepresentation of Indigenous kids in care? It's like, you know, we, again, tricking people, but we're really honest journalists, I promise, but like tricking people into learning about Canadian history through a compelling narrative story. And for me, that was one of the most enjoyable things about the podcast, is like trying to figure out how we weave those things in and out, and that you have the ability to tell stories about Indigenous people or anybody in a meaningful way that lets people, that kind of inherently combats the stereotypes that exist and that are often perpetuated when you only have a minute 30 or 2 minutes 30 or 15 minutes, mm-hmm. that you can make people whole people, and you can create space for listeners to have empathy for people that whose lived experiences they may not identify with. And right. And I love that.
Can I interject? I think Finding Cleo, Connie's very humble. If you go back and listen to Finding Cleo with an ear to the, go and listen again, I've worked on long-form storytelling in my other jobs for a very long time. Mm. That structure, the reveal, the stuff that seems so effortless, the way the story is told, it's a master class in how to tell a story and a structure, how to insert yourself the right way and not too much, but just like you feel you're with Connie, and like when she's going to knock on the door and, oh, are you going to keep that on the record or not, or like all of that stuff. But the actual telling of that story, if you listen to it with that ear of just, you will learn so much about how to structure a story by listening to Finding Cleo. It's really like, I cannot say enough, because it just blew me away. And they even had a thing at, like, they do a lunch and learn at CBC, mm-hmm. and there was a Finding Cleo lunch and learn, and I was sitting there going, okay, what did you guys do? How did you figure out that structure? It's so brilliant.
Right.
It really stands alone.
Now, listen, this was not...
It's sweaty palms now.
It's not like you'd been in podcasting for 20 years by the time you made that.
I'd never done a radio documentary before we did the first season of Who Killed Alberta Williams.
Wow.
I didn't say that in my pitch to CBC about let us do a podcast.
So what do you think made it work? What do you think in your sort of intuitive journalist brain kind of made the structure appear?
We had this team, Marnie, Luke, and Heather Evans and I for the first season, and then Jen Fowler joined us for the second season, and Mika Anderson. I think that what was our strength was that, you know, we were building off of years of reporting on these issues, and like I said, not always getting it Right. Like, you know, I feel like we really did a lot of like learning and understanding what was working and what we were missing in those earlier stories so that we knew what we had to include in the first season and then the second season. But it was really also just paying attention to the context. When we were writing the first season of Who Killed Alberta Williams, like, that really seemed like a natural podcast because there were so many twists and turns and we couldn't tell it in a 10-minute story even if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the fourth episode when I actually went home to Saskatchewan. I'd been invited to a conference there, and this was the fall after Colton Bushy was shot and killed in Saskatchewan. And some of the Indigenous journalists who were working in newsrooms there across the province, not just for CBC but in other newsrooms, organized a conference called Reconciliation and the Media. And it was an attempt to try to help all of the journalists in Saskatchewan who were covering these stories better understand the context. And the keynote speaker that day was Dr. Marie Wilson from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She was a commissioner. Mm-hmm. And she's a former journalist. And she used her keynote to basically kind of chastise every journalist in the room, saying, you guys need to do a better job. You need to do a better job of telling these stories. You need to connect the dots for people, that context is the most important thing. And you should always be asking yourself, when did this story actually begin? If you can't connect the dots meaningfully in this story, do it in the next story. Like, think about when these stories actually began. And I thought about Alberta Williams at that time. She had died in 1989 on the Highway of Tears, and we were investigating her unsolved murder, you know, decades later. And I thought about, when did her story begin? It was before her death, before the night she disappeared. It was before her birth, even. It was the story of her family. It was the story of colonization and the story of the relationship with the RCMP. Why was this unsolved for 30 years? What is it about that relationship between Indigenous people and the RCMP? It was about the legacies of residential schools. Mm-hmm. The main suspect in her case was a residential school survivor, and how was that interwoven with the bigger story? And that's when I was about to write the fourth episode, which ended up being almost all about the history of residential schools in Canada. Mm-hmm. That really kind of informed the way that we approached. And then when people listened, that was the thing that they commented on. People want that context. People want to be able to better understand these stories.
Mm-hmm. Vicky, you try to teach this stuff, right, professionally. So that's part of what you do for a living. You're an editor of The Conversation, but also you run Vocal Fry Studios. People knock at your door and say, Vicky, please, I want to make a podcast. Where do I start? What do you say to them?
I say lots of things, which is, you know, people come almost universally, but a lot of our clients come with a show that they want, a style that they want to make. Most of the time, and I would say like 90% of the time, it's, I want to make a show like the New York Times as the Daily. And I say, log on to their website, pick an episode, scroll to the bottom, count the number of bodies, count the number of people, multiply that number times 80,000, because they're at the New York Times, they're making good money, and that's the amount of money this will require. And I think that's what's missing constantly. You know, we're talking about how much money podcasts make. That's the end product. What does it take to actually make that show? You know, with Connie's show, with Finding Cleo, I think one of your producers was on Ontario Today or something like that, and they mentioned for a year, I think you had four producers on that, approximately?
No, yeah, there was a team of four, and it took a year from beginning to end, but not everyone was full-time.
So four people at some point. Mm-hmm. I've come to the point, I think, after a couple years, where I'm far less interested in the show. I think if you throw enough people with talent and passion at a show, it can be really, really good. I'm most interested in what the investment is in that show at the top. A lot of shows or a lot of projects that we've turned back or refused to do are almost always because this is underfunded. You're not thinking appropriately about how this show is meant to start. You know, people want to launch a show in 3 months. No. No, don't do that to yourself. Don't task the people that you work with that kind of responsibility. And don't set yourselves up for failure. Mm-hmm. Unless this is something you're willing to do independently and let it grow slowly and organically, then I think you're setting a lot of people up for failure. And so when I think about shows, I really think about, like, what's that initial investment look like? One of the frustrations I'm beginning to have with the industry is simply how it's replicating the exact same sets of power structures traditional media has already had. tasking people with impossible jobs under conditions that are not well paid, they're poorly resourced, and they're not trained to do that, or they're not skilled up enough to do that. That's not to say people don't have the passion or the time, but if you're earning $45,000 working for a corporation that wants you to do a show on a daily basis, and you're not Michael Barbaro with 20 producers, that's a setup for failure. It absolutely is. And so I think that's something to think about constantly, not just what is the profit potential, but what are we doing to at least a layer of the industry and burning them out. I talk to a lot of podcast producers. That's mostly who we hire. And if you're not talent, man, those people are being eaten alive. Joe Rogan makes $30 million, but Joe Rogan pays his producers really, really well. You might hate him, but the staff around him look really happy. Check out their Instagrams. Those people go on vacations. They go on vacations. Find me a CBC podcast producer who has gone on a vacation in the last 2 years. I'm really curious to see what that looks like, because there's a lot of really unhappy people at a certain layer. Mm-hmm. And I think we can talk about the profits, but on whose back and whose labor is that profit being made? That's worth thinking about. And so I really love when you say, like, when does that story actually begin? We're starting right now at the midpoint, or I guess, I don't know if it's the midpoint of the industry, but at a point in the industry, we're not really pulling back to see when this really began. Mm-hmm. And who gets to benefit out of it? Some of these, there are big names, there are talents who are exactly the same sets of talents that would have been a decade ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Does it look substantially different? We focus on unicorns, we focus on, you know, Connie, Ryan McMahon, but I know so many young, talented Indigenous people who are making shows that are never gonna get the time of day from the institutions that would have the resources to do it. That's who I talk to, that's who I teach. They're desperate for this attention. They're working so, so hard, doing full-time jobs and trying to make the shows that they're making and trying to tell the stories that they're telling. But if there's a passion for podcasting and a desire to support that level, I'm not seeing it. I just meet a lot of really stressed out people, terribly desperate to figure out how to make this work and not being able, no one's opening those doors for them. We try to, but we're a small production company. We're not CBC or Rogers or Chorus. We can teach, and we can help them harness that energy, but I genuinely spend a lot of time managing expectations and telling people, like, give it time. They're not looking at you yet. They're not used to looking at you. They're beginning to. Mm-hmm. If 11 million Canadians have listened to a podcast in last year, we should get really granular about that data and think about who's listening to a podcast every day. We genuinely do not have the market penetration of podcast listenership that they do in Europe, which is why we're still not quite investing, mm-hmm. because there just isn't that audience there yet. But that means we're still under-investing in a lot of stories.
So it feels like a gold rush for some people, right? It feels like a gold rush for some people who are like, I think I'm gonna start a podcast. This feels like the right moment to do that. What do you think it is about the medium that kind of obscures this giant machinery that it takes to make one successful? Because, like you said, you can't just start one when you don't have that kind of support. But yet everyone kind of thinks that they can. What's with that?
It's like a lot of things, which is that the people who make the product become invisible in the marketing of the product. Mm-hmm. You know that Beyonce is running Ivy Park. You don't know who made any of those running shoes. Right. And so I think it's important to look at the producers. These people, I mean, our producers work crazy hard. And I'll be honest, they work harder than me, but I get to sit on a stage. They get to disappear. And so I think we really, really need to talk more about, like, what's involved in that work. I think it's really good to talk about the stories that are out there. But when you listen to a podcast, listen for every single cut. Listen for every single bit of music. Listen for each different note. Listen for each different voice. Because that's an email sent. That is somebody who's had to listen to thousands of music beds. That is somebody who's had to make decisions. There have been had to be story editors involved. The work, it sounds effortless because somebody put a ton of effort into it, and usually teams of people put tons of effort into it. And so I just, at this point, I listen to lots of podcasts, and I just try to hear how many people were involved, because I think it's important to not just see the industry as this opportunity to make a ton of money. I think it's possibly a new opportunity to think about the labor of the media industry in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I'm terrified because I still see the same things happening. where we're focused on the stars and the brand names and less so on the people who made that possible.
What you're talking about is a kind of literacy that I think most of us could use when we just consume any kind of media at all, but especially something as intimate as podcasting, because, you know, in my mind, I'm like, you go into a closet with a bunch of people, and then you're like, let's just make some jokes, and then that'll be the podcast. But that's obviously not the case. Like, that's, there's so much more to it built than that. You were going to add something.
Well, I was just going to underline what Vicky said. Everything that seems effortless never is, right? So it takes a lot of work to sound like that. So there are a lot of people out there who think that to do audio work is to just turn on a mic and start talking and never think about what you're, where you're going to start, where you're going to finish, what you have to do that, how much goes into the production around it. So everybody thinks they can do it, and they don't understand that it does cost money to do it, and it, like, there are talented people behind, you know, doing a lot of that work. And without them, you don't have a podcast, right? You just, like, it's like, you know, you can make a movie with your iPhone,
right?
But you know, so it's the same kind of thing. But the important thing is that there is talent bubbling up through that, because there are people for whom they can get their hands on some of that. And maybe they can, like, you know, they will be noticed. But it is very hard. But it is absolutely, you know, the number of people who have, you know, when I said I'm going to have a podcast, the number of people said, well, I'll be a great interview for you. Like, like, they don't understand what a focus is, where you're going to go with something. They you know, or they say, I've got a podcast too, and which is great. But a podcast takes a lot of work. And takes a lot of work. It's a team.
David,
people
how do
succeed on their own?
How do I differentiate between I have a good idea for a podcast, or I just think I'm funny with my friends and we should record ourselves? Not to be mean.
Well, what I learned about this business, and I really took a lot from what you were saying, is it takes a lot of perseverance. We're an independent; we're not on a platform, so people had to find us. We weren't pushed out at anybody, and it took a, you know, I mean, we worked at this for 3 years. And it isn't, and when I say we, so to your point about how many people it takes, there are four people plus myself that work on this. It takes about 25% of my professional time. So in reality, the amount of money that I've put into it that way, and everybody's involved has put money into it. I don't know what kind of a gold rush it is, because none of us have gotten any money out of it at this point.
You got
a t-shirt. I got a t-shirt out of it. You know, and we're lucky. Like, we occasionally sneak into the top 10 of public affairs podcasts in the country. In terms of what goes into it, I mean, there's a tremendous, anybody that thinks they can do this on their own, there's a tremendous amount of logistics involved and technical expertise that is involved in writing and getting guests and all that. And if you're going to do it, one of the things we learned is regularity is critically important. At the beginning of our podcast, we would put them out when we could get them together. It's really impossible to build an audience that way. They've got to know it's coming on Tuesday, and it's going to show up on Tuesday. That's their day to get that. So that puts a discipline and a rigor on what you're doing. And the Jenny and Scott panel is the easiest thing we do. Because that is really just, we agree on beforehand what we're going to talk about generally, and then we go in and we just riff off of it, and she's naturally charming and Scott's naturally funny, and it works. The other podcasts are tremendously time consuming. When I'm doing a one-on-one, one-hour interview with somebody, the first of all, finding those people is a part of what my team has to do, is find them, book them, get the studio ready, get all that stuff done. And then I've got to come in there and I've got to know a lot about them. I've got to have read their most recent book, if not more than their most recent book. And I have got to give it a lot of thought to, as Anna Maria said, how are you going to structure this interview? What's going to be different about this interview than the 800 other ones that the person gave? And how am I going to differentiate that? So it's a tremendous amount of work for, in the vast majority of cases, not a lot, if any, financial reward. Right. We've gotten a tremendous amount of psychic reward out of it, mm-hmm. and now we have sponsors, so there is a little bit of money involved that's given us the money to add video, for example. So there's, you know, I mean, we started off thinking we were joining a gold rush. We started off thinking, hey, this podcasting, this is the new thing, this could really work.
Right.
And after about 2 years, we were like, you know, this is pretty darn tough. And it can be dispiriting to try to grow your audience little bit by little bit. So I would say, echo what you were saying. Make sure you've got a team of people around you that can really support you and help you through this thing. Mm-hmm. Be very patient about what it takes to build an audience. And try to think hard about what will differentiate you. And I've had to learn some lessons. We started off, which we wanted a basic, you know, we wanted it to be fun, and we wanted it to be conversational, and we wanted people to be able to swear if they swear, and all that kind of stuff. But that in itself doesn't make it work. I've had to learn some lessons. For instance, I started off and I thought, I'm an interesting guy. I'll be interesting on anything. So I'm going to interview musicians, and I'm going to interview sports figures, and I'm going to interview all the things that interest me. Well, the hard reality is people are interested in hearing me talk about politics, not music, not sports, as brilliant as I am on both of those subjects, right? So over time, if we get a great artist who's prepared to come on, we might still do that. But we know now that our show is about politics. It's not about David Hurley's interests. It's about politics.
Right.
And narrowing that started to help us build an audience more, too, because people got a consistency of product week after week. Right? Yeah. Same person that wants to hear me talk to Robbie Robertson. It's not the same person that wants to hear me talk to Thomas Frank.
Right.
You're going to hear less musicians.
I mean, that's very upsetting to me because I like the Robbie Robertson interview, but it's fine.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess when I hear that, I start to wonder about your show because it's like a lot of people found out you had the show during the election.
Right.
Right? So the election was sort of a turning point in terms of, at least it reads that way, that in terms of the awareness of the podcast, kind of seemed to have turned.
Audience about tripled since then.
Tripled since the election.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Because people want to hear you talk about politics.
I think because there's magic to that panel. I think we just struck some magic. There's a chemistry to that people really enjoy.
Right.
There's content that they really enjoy. So it's a combination of information and entertainment that we just happened upon. Really, we didn't know that it was going to be the success it has, but there's no question that that took the podcast to a different level and a different level of listenership, and then you get sponsors, and then that changes your mind.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Nosy, what's that number? What's that tripled number now?
10,000. Right?
Yeah, that's the number. 10,000 is the magic number for sponsors, really. Especially if you're an independent, rather. I think it's institutional or network-wide. It's different. But 10,000 is a number for an independent. So, again, like, that takes a bunch of time
to get there,
I think, is what David would say. And I think anyone who's running an independent show could say, like, you're investing a lot of money up front and a lot of time and a lot of people's energy for an audience that might never arrive.
Right.
And so I think that's something to always think about when you're starting a show. And sometimes your audience might never hit that 10,000. It might be under that. But a good 5,000 is better than an inconsistent 20,000. That's my personal belief because they're the ones who will show up for your shows. They'll buy merchandise when you decide to get a book or whatever. Mm-hmm. They will show up for that. And I think we tend to think about audiences in this sort of like Netflix way where it's like we're trying to hit 12 million. I don't know that that's fair to the audience themselves. If they've given you time, the question to me is always how much more time do they have for you rather than how many more of them can I get?
Yeah, we don't have sponsors on the basis of our numbers. We have sponsors on the basis of sponsors' assessment of the qualitative value of our audience, which is highly concentrated in government, politics, journalism. And so if you're trying to reach those people, it's as good a way as any to reach them.
Right.
But no, I mean, if we had to sell the traditional media metrics, it would be worth nothing. Okay.
Now, you guys expressed some kind of skepticism about sort of this gold rush moment, but the headlines are kind of flashy, right? Like last year, Spotify spent $400 million on acquisitions, including $230 million on Gimlet Media, which is where you are now. Mm-hmm. This week, the news was that they just bought The Ringer. Not The Ringer podcast, just The Ringer. But like, we'll take all of that, that's fine. But they're really in it for the podcast. And so it feels like an arms race moment with these platforms, who are at least like pumping as much money out as possible try to acquire as many voices as possible. So it feels like a sort of a professionalization of the medium. Like it's gone from, you know, a sort of a thing you do in your garage to this professional thing where they'll spend $230 million buying your company if you can produce a few good podcasts. Connie, what's that universe like? No pressure, you don't have to tell me.
It's very different than, I mean, I was at CBC for 19 years.
Yeah.
So that was my only job, actually, in journalism, was at CBC. I started as an intern in 2000, and then I just never left. And so, you know, it's a very different work environment. Like, I just keep saying, everyone says, how's it going again? I'm like, it's great. It's very, very different. Mm-hmm. So it's a big adjustment. I mean, generally, I would just say, like, I feel incredibly lucky to be in an environment that is like podcast is what they do. I feel like, you know, before that I was a reporter for CBC News for a number of years, and that is like being a TV reporter, being a radio reporter, being a digital reporter, mm-hmm. Being a social media reporter. It's like, you know, which is fantastic, and it's a great place to work, and there are lots of really talented people doing that. Once I did the podcast, once I did Missing and Murdered, you know, I feel like that really, really spoiled me for other kinds of storytelling that I really wanted to be able to continue that. Mm-hmm. I feel like we were, with the goals that I had as an Indigenous journalist, wanting to, you know, help people understand the true realities that Indigenous people face in this country, podcasts just seemed like the perfect place to do that. And so, you know, it was really hard for me to think about, you know, not continuing that in the same way. So to be at a place where they're like, that's fantastic, we want you to do these stories, we want to help support that, I'm like, this seems like a dream come true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody has one. Eventually everybody will have a podcast, right?
That's the future.
It feels like everybody's going to have a podcast. Everybody's starting them, right? A long time I asked Peter Manchmer to come on my podcast. He said, no. Then I saw he started one of his own. I had Bob Ray on my podcast. He didn't know what a podcast was when he showed up to be on the podcast. Then he said, no way, you can sit here for 45 minutes and just talk. The next thing I knew, he had his own podcast.
Sure. No.
But I think that speaks to what I was saying earlier about like the people who get noticed for the podcasts or whose podcast will sustain and survive this arms race moment are still effectively the same sets of people. I mean, Peter Mandridge was fine 20 years ago, and Peter Mandridge is going to be fine now with his podcast. What I think it were still missing, and I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts from the States, and almost all of them are Black podcasters who are really doing really, really well for themselves. Mm-hmm. And if I were to look around this country, and I don't think anybody could name me a prominent Black podcaster who's not this guy. You know,
or a
single show focused on Black Canadians in this country, and think about it, it's Black History Month. What are you listening to that's focused on that community or those people? I highly recommend listening to Black Tea from Rogers Frequency Network, but it's also a show that is in the conditions I've already mentioned. As for the arms race, I think I really enjoy it. I like Spotify taking a swipe at Apple, which is effectively what they're doing, trying to bring people to their platform. Mm-hmm. I think it's smart and it's strategic. I think, again, we're going to see some of the same labor issues play out. I think Gimlet had their own union problems as a result of the Spotify acquisition. The Ringer is going through the same union problems as a result of this acquisition. So there's a ton of money. But the labor that's doing this work, you know, Bill Simmons will get his equity and his cash, and his investors will be very happy. Whether any of those writers who form those shows will leave happy as a result, let's come back to me in 3 years, and I will say happily, no.
Are you
a good chunk
no
of them
right
will
now
be terribly unhappy.
Right.
And I think that's still worth interrogating. This feels new, but you know, even the Spotify acquisition, it's the same sets of media convergences that we've seen over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. I really have to apologize to my parents for this because they paid for me to take a fancy communications degree. And what I learned is that these patterns replicate themselves. It happened in TV, it happened in radio, it's happened in all forms of media, and it's happening again in podcasting. It feels new, but the machinery of it is almost exactly the same.
Why is that process hidden, do you think?
Because it feels new, it's different, it's shiny, and I think because people talk about, because it's intimate, people talk about those stories.
But it's also it's like opened up, like it's more accessible to people who don't traditionally have those whose voices aren't amplified on the traditional platforms in radio and television. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I feel like that's one thing that absolutely I'm not disagreeing with anything you say in terms of who is doing the work and who's paying for that. But it is, I think, different in that, or at least it started out being different in that it was a creation in the same way that all digital media allowed for an amplification of voices that you didn't traditionally hear on the radio or on television all the time. Now you're hearing, like, obviously, like, Conan O'Brien has a podcast. Alec Baldwin, like, all those people, like you said, are having a podcast. So they're entering the space and will take up a lot of space. But I think that there still is, like, a fantastic opportunity for people who wouldn't necessarily get that same chance to be on those traditional platforms.
Is there room for everyone, Anna Maria?
I would agree that the other side of that, and I'm not going to disagree with what you're saying. The other side of that is that 10 years ago, those jobs didn't exist. This whole thing that, like, there was podcasting, but it wasn't at this level. And so the ability, like, you know, and in this country, if you wanted to do any work audio that was long form, there were very few. Outside of the CBC, there was almost no place to go. Mm-hmm. It's why I joined the CBC. There was nothing in private radio, nothing. So the jump over the course of my career, the ability to see that going, and yeah, I've been in this a long time, and I'm still in this, and now I've moved to podcasting, but at the same time, there is sort of a marriage of different kinds of mediums, right? Mm-hmm. And I see that it's the technology that has allowed this, the monetization and the large media companies, they see opportunity there. They see new stories coming out because they need content. And that's the other thing. The podcasts are becoming, the incubator for visual things. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people want a little bit of that space. But in between, there's an opportunity for people who couldn't get a voice at all to still get some experience and try to get that voice and get in there. It's not going to be easy for everyone. And yes, there are labor issues. At the same time, there's a whole new way to tell a story and to be able to get a story out there that was not open to people without this technology before.
I mean, the part of Vicky's point that I'm interested in here is that, if it ends up being the same voices, then was this space really new? Like, talking about Bob Ray, I'm not sure that Bob Ray's ever had sort of a want of a platform throughout his career.
Generally, people know what he thinks, yeah.
Right, yeah. But now he's got a new one.
Right.
Right. What do we do with this?
Well, I mean, I think that people, quality will determine it, right? I mean, this is kind of a very democratic exercise out there. Your show has to survive. And not all of these people, I'm not going to name any names, but not all these people's podcasts are successful.
Sure.
Podcasts, just because they're a big name that's doing it. It's going to be successful the first episode because you're a big name that's doing it. But if the show isn't entertaining or interesting, they're not going to come back. So I think this is a pretty ruthless market in terms of you got to earn that audience all the time. There's so many options for them. Mm. I think the audiences will sort that out.
But not to go back and make the same point again, but these stories that in particular Indigenous stories have always been important stories. They've always been issues in Canada, but for a long time the people who were making those editorial decisions in newsrooms for television and radio didn't necessarily think they were important. I remember, you know, when we started CBC Aboriginal, I had a story that was going to be on the National, and I called into the desk, and they were like, "Oh, we already have an Indigenous story tonight, we're going to hold yours till tomorrow," because you couldn't have two in one night. 1 year later, we were at the Truth and Reconciliation, and digital media and their popularity and the fact that you actually had metrics that show how many people download a podcast, how many people click on a story. 1 year later, it was the Truth and Reconciliation event in Ottawa, the final event, and I was there covering for the National. It led the National 5 nights in a row, like 1 year later. And the first, the night the final report was released, the first 15 minutes of the entire show was all TRC coverage. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that we would have gotten a podcast like Missing and Murdered if it wasn't, you know, that was focused on Indigenous issues, because for a long time, you know, there wasn't the recognition that those were important stories or that there was an audience for them. Mm-hmm. Podcasting and the way that we are able to approach the stories, I think, has created a space that people understand. I mean, I think, you know, it's also the popularity of true crime, mm-hmm. which we didn't get to talk about, but that has kind of proven that there is that space.
And I think there's a space for very serious work like that, and I've always believed that, right? If you do it, they will come. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't have to be what the big corporations want, the tap dancing and the song and dance. If you really believe in a story, no matter how tough it is, they will come. And but you have to have the courage of those convictions and keep plugging away at it and fighting for it. And you know, and then people will realize, you know, oh, I need to know this. You know, we need to give audiences more credit than we often do, right? And they will have good ears for things. Sure, they're going, you know, so those kinds of things, if you offer it, they will go, oh, I'm glad I'm learning about this. I really find it interesting now that in the United States, the New York Times is doing stories on missing and murdered. Like, I've never seen this. Like, they were never doing this before, right?
Like, New York Times, Vice, HBO, like, everyone is in the United States now. It's really, it's an interesting time to be there.
Last of my questions will go to you, Vicky. Joe Rogan's always at the top.
Yeah.
I'm
Here
mad
we go.
About it. I'm constantly mad about it. That's a whole other conversation. How sophisticated is this audience? Not to be rude again. Yeah.
The Joe Rogan audience?
No, the podcasting audience.
The podcasting audience?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the audiences are as sophisticated as you are. I try to think of my audience. I think of all of our audiences with a great amount of generosity because I'm asking quite a lot of them when we're asking them to listen to anything. So I'm less interested in sophistication of the audience and more in sophistication of the show itself and how we try to think through, like, yes, podcasting requires sometimes a different pace and you have to tease out ideas a bit more slowly and you have to explain out ideas differently, but the worst shows, the ones I can't bear to listen to, talk down to you. And I think this is what people forget about Joe Rogan, is he sits there and tells the people he's interviewing, I'm an idiot, tell me more.
For 3 hours.
And he does that.
Yeah.
And there are shows where you can feel that the host refuses to be anything less than the most brilliant person in the room. And I think that really ultimately harms the audiences that we have, in that it teaches audiences that it's okay to ignore expertise in some way. You can't ask more interesting questions, or you can't engage with ideas by just saying, I don't know. And so I think that's the one thing you should listen, if you listen to Joe Rogan for, he's always willing to say, like, I've got this dumb idea, does this work? And he'll say it to an expert. Sure, he'll obviously also say it to some incredibly toxic people who create actual harms in our political and cultural discourse, but he does a very interesting thing where he sits in the place of the audience.
So does Michael Barbaro, I think, in The Daily. Like, I feel like he's essentially asking the reporters, explain what happened yesterday at the impeachment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's really good shows that do that. I love Vox's Today Explained for that, where he'll just say, like, he's having fun with an idea or he's engaged with an idea, but he's willing to say, I don't know anything about it, so here's who's going to tell us about it. But at the same time, that's such a, I think that's a marker of respect for the audience to say, I'm the host, but I'm no better than you. And I think that's such a meaningful act of humanity for people. Mm-hmm. I think it's the sort of thing, like, I don't know, if you were hanging out with a five-year-old and they ask you questions, you can't be like, well, child, you've studied nothing. And I think that's, there are shows that do that. And I always just go, well, this is why I actively dislike you, so I can only imagine how many people you lose as a result, you know? And so honestly, political podcasts do this all the time, and there are quite a number I won't listen to for that very reason. I think you guys do a great job of both talking and explaining, being keenly aware that your audience doesn't necessarily need every detail explained to them. But I think it's a really important choice to think of your audience in the most generous and caring way, because they're giving you 30 minutes of their day at some point. They're doing it, whether they're washing dishes, they're with their kids in the car, they're giving you so much of their time, and especially, as we've mentioned, like, in a time where audiences are pulled apart in every single direction and everyone's demanding something from them, they've given you time. It is an incredible act of humanity to think of your audience with all of that generosity because they've given it to you. And I think the data tells us quite a lot. You know, one of the biggest growing, not growing, but an audience that's steadily growing in podcasting is women, I believe, 45 to 55. There's clearly, there's a desire there. But I think they're growing, and the shows that they're going towards tell us how. Some of them are wellness shows, some of them are kind of like Goop style shows, whatever. But it tells us what they want. But also, when you listen to those shows, you hear the hosts and whoever's created the show has put a ton of heart and love and joy into that show. Mm. And they're not always, you know, light topics. But they're really careful with their audience, and they're kind to them. They're consistent, which I think is important to always note. And so, you know, I think you can roast Joe Rogan for being a terrible human being, and I will happily do it. And I cannot bear when my boyfriend plays it. But I can also hear that show as a producer and hear how much Joe appreciates his audience.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that all the time, that the audience deserves our admiration for the time that they've given us.
And an audience that deserves our admiration is this audience right here. See that segue? Did you like it?
That was good. That was good.
I hated
very good.
It, so I hope you didn't like it. We're going to open up some questions for you guys. There's a microphone right there. Please come on up.
Hi there. My name is Teresa Epton, Director of Innovation Marketing globally at Accenture. I've worked on a few podcasts over the last couple of years. Pivot to the Future with Will.i.am and Omar Abbosh, and The AI Effect with Amanda Lang and Jody Wallace, our AI lead for Canada. And aside from having really good content, which I always let our executive producer, Stuart Cox, make sure he was handling, I am really passionate about a good marketing plan for podcasts because I think that it's more than just having good content. There are little things that you do, and sometimes big things that you do, to get your podcast elevated and get people to hear it so they hear that awesome content. So I wanted to ask each of you, what is the turning point for you? What really worked to get your podcast out there?
Made a big difference for us to add video. And not so much because of what it did to our audience, although it did expand our audience by bringing in YouTube viewers, but it made our social media promotion of the podcast so much more compelling. So in Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram, you get a video clip of the podcast, and that's so much more engaging for the viewer. So yeah, I think that's probably the most successful thing that we have done to boost promotion of the pod is to introduce video into our social media.
Good. We put out quite a number of shows, and each of them have different needs. But we try to think in extremely granular ways about what will make a show work. So for a sort of interview podcast, one thing we always push with clients is to publish that transcript. One, it improves accessibility because podcasting excludes almost by definition people who have hearing issues. But if you publish a transcript, they can still engage with your podcast, and I think you don't want to necessarily lose that audience. And there's lots of reasons why people don't have time to listen, but they want to flip through the transcript. The other one is we don't always, with clients, we just say, like, your marketing department should do what your marketing department does, but what are other ways that your audience exists and lives in the real world? Like, genuinely, one of the podcasts we've worked on, the thing that nailed it for them was we just had them make little cards of the show's logo and on the back how people can listen to podcasts, period. Not even the show, how people can listen to podcasts. We still don't have
so many people don't know that.
People don't know how to access them, right? And so it's something that we just push to people all the time. Like, if your show isn't getting listened to, is it because your audience genuinely doesn't know what button on their phone gets them a podcast? It might be that. And so you kind of have to think through those moments and those opportunities.
Well, my podcast only dropped last week. Second episode is up now.
Congratulations.
And it's a little different because I have the CBC behind me on this one, and so it has very generously promoted that. And we actually beat Joe Rogan for a week.
I bet he's so mad about that.
but I think that for me, the what I'm doing with it in order to try to have that longevity is I'm bringing what I had before to the table and trying to have a different kind of conversation where I get to know a little bit more about somebody and where it lasts longer. I'm used to doing things that are really about of the day or the week, and I have consumed a lot of information and regurgitated it like literally all the time, all the time, all the time. And this time it's a different kind of conversation, and it's meant to hang on to you later so that you hear something that you didn't hear before, that you hear again with the audience. I want you to be, and I don't think of my audience in terms of numbers, I think of my audience in terms of one person. And I want that one person to be in the room with me. So for me, it's a headspace, it's a zone, right? And it's something, yes, you have to pump it out on social media and everything else, but when they listen, if I want them to come back, what you have to do is you have to feel you were in the room with me. And there are people that I was listening to, and I won't use names either on podcasts, but it would be like if you were in the room with them and you said, oh yeah, they'd go, who the hell are you? Like, what are you doing in the room with the two of us, right? And it's something that's really nuanced, but I think it matters a lot. And it's the one thing I've learned over time with audio, right? And it's something you build. And so I've been lucky to come out the gate with a lot of help, but I have but the rest of my career has been about the slow build. It's never been about hit them hard. It's always been about slowly build. And so this one's a little different, and I have to, you know, the one thing I stopped myself, Samantha Bee knew who I was, and I was like, oh my God, I felt like, you know, what's the Oscar winner who goes, you love me, like, seriously? Like, because, you know, and so I have to be careful not to fangirl a little bit with some of, but she's next, I think. But that's what I think will make the difference for me. It's very, very much in the zone and making whoever is listening feel like they're right there with me and with that other person. And if there's more audience, the three of us, the listener, me, and the, we don't know that. We are talking to each other. So I go that way.
I also was really lucky to have like CBC release the podcast and get to go on The Current and talk about the new project and et cetera. But the big thing I think that, especially for new podcasts are coming out, like we just engaged with our audience. That's the thing that I love about social media is, and digital media in particular, is that you can actually talk to people. Like you put it out there and you get an echo back right away and you can connect with them if you choose to. And I was like, I was just, every single person that mentioned the, like searching Finding Cleo on like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and like every single person that mentioned it, I was like, thanks so much for listening, and like just trying to do everything that I could to just keep it going. And we also were able to like, you know, connect with people who like were doing podcasts that were similar, or you know, just connecting with people. It's all marketing stuff, but like that would be beneficial or mutually beneficial for you to be connecting with.
I just photograph really well.
You didn't expect that to be that funny, did you?
Yeah. No, not, it's like, no, wait a minute. I expected like a 7, not a 9, you know, it's a problem. I likewise also had the might of the CBC machine behind our podcast. I will say that one thing that really made our podcast work is that I think we had the same questions that our audiences had, and we sort of stayed close to what those questions were. And so it made it really easy to engage on an episode. Like the end of the episode wasn't the end of the conversation. It's very much built as that kind of conversational podcast. It also helped to have the election. It's like, you know, you spend 8 months just watching the circus that is US politics, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait, we're an election place. I gotta get caught up to speed. And our podcast kind of hit the wave at the right moment of what we sort of needed to capture an audience that's like, I'm interested in being brought back to Canadian politics. That, and I'm incredibly charming. So that's it. Like, those were the machinery of our marketing. Any other questions up there? Microphone's free. Come on up.
So the question I have for you, for all of you, is if you are aware of any innovative ways and uses of sound, like ASMR, and any podcasts that really do it well?
ASMR podcast.
I'm a technological idiot, so I have no idea. But.
So it's Autonomous Meridian Response, I think. Autonomous.
ASMR is like, I don't want to do it because I know it's so horrifying for a lot of people.
Do it.
It's like if I talk to you.
It's like a lot of whispered, enhanced kind of sound.
Yeah. Oh, the shadows.
It's honestly, go home on YouTube, click ASMR, go down this rabbit hole. It'll horrify you, but you will have party conversation for the next like month and a half. But yeah, there's lots of really good, interesting sound design. I am currently in love with the work of the people who are behind Constellations, and it's Michelle Macklem, who's an audio producer here, but I forget her partner. But they're working on audio sound design. And so each podcast that they work with people on, they're doing sound design work. And so they had, for example, Phoebe Wang, who is a podcast producer in Canada but has done a lot of American work, has done episodes and storytelling for them. And it's sound design focused. Rather, it's stories part of it, but the focus there is sound design. One I really, really am in love with is a podcast called Have You Heard George's Podcast? It's from the BBC. And it's a guy named George the Poet, and he's doing a podcast. The entire podcast is a poem, but then he also is from a very rap and hip-hop infused neighborhood in London, and so all of that comes in. It's fascinating. Like, if you want to hear a show that is at the apex of sound design and is like the next wave of what podcasts will be doing, I would really, really recommend that show. And I think one thing that gets underrated is that very straightforward podcasts, for example, like More, are actually doing quite a lot of work with sound design. So listening, becoming a really close listener for any of the students in the back who are producers and burgeoning producers, become a really, really close listener. Listen for warmth and tone and volume, all of those pieces, because even if it's a single set of sounds in that show, like a single piece of music that carries that show, figuring out how they're using it is an excellent way to think about sound design. Not every show has to be multiple layers of sound design. Mm-hmm. It can be a few layers of sound design and still create a really warm and rich sound. So those are the three things I can think of off the top of my head.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Because Arman Agbali, are you in here, Arman? I don't know. But he, we were picking sound, and I was reading to it, and there were a couple of them that we liked, but then I would start like reading to the music pod, and that like that's not what I was supposed to be doing, right? It's like, because I'm not George the Poet.
Oh my God, I really want to hear this draft tape.
Those are outtakes, yeah. The other, Caitlin Prest did The Shadows, and there are some really interesting moments in there that if you wouldn't have an earbud in, you wouldn't hear, and I just have to say The Moth. You'll know what I'm talking about when you get to it. But really, really very beautiful sound and that advances the storyline.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also going to shout out our podcast we make. It's the Maple Leafs podcast, Leafs Forever. My wonderful business partner, Katie Jensen, is a genius at sound design. She's genuinely a composer of music, so when we make music, she gets composers to make them, and we'll tell them, like, that note's out of place, change that. That's like a deep level of skill, and so you'll hear on that show the level of sound design. The first 3 minutes of the first episode about the Maple Leafs going to Newfoundland or being stuck essentially in Newfoundland during 9/11 is like jaw-droppingly beautiful sound design.
Anybody else?
My friend wrote me a great theme song.
I was going to ask, so did all of you have theme songs made for your podcast or no? Did you take stock?
Yeah, I just found it on the internet one night.
Okay.
I was like, this sounds good. It was actually when we were doing the pitch for to our bosses at CBC to convince them to let us do a podcast, and I just found this music on the internet, and I included it. I made a PowerPoint presentation of like what each episode would look like, and I included this music in it, and then it kind of just got stuck in my head as the music, and I didn't want to change it after that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Anybody else? I think he's coming up, then you're coming up.
Sure.
So Canadian.
Very Canadian, yeah. Here, are we?
Hello. My name's Colin. I'm a host of a podcast called On Docs for TVO, and I know El Amin. What's up, man? My question is about hosting. You're all great talkers. Your personalities really shine up on stage and on your podcast as well. And I'm wondering how you got to that point. I find it's very hard to, for me personally, I always notice I say a lot. And I'm trying to break that habit, but it's very hard. And I just wonder how you guys get over that, I guess.
Editing?
I mean, I think I just genuinely remember the very first episode I sat down for Canada Land Commons. I turned to our producer and I said, make me sound like Anna Maria Tremonti, and he laughed. He just laughed so hard and was like, just ask the questions. Yeah. But since then, I think it's editing myself a lot. You hear your own verbal tics and you learn to remove them. I learned to slow down how I talk. I also picked up tips from how other people are in podcasting and how they interview and how they talk. And, you know, how I am here on stage is very different from how I am hosting in front of a mic. I'm a lot more fun, I promise. But it's, I think like everyone else is saying, it's time, it's practice, and treating it like, I mean, it is your job, but treating it like your job, which is to say, you do the research for your job in any other capacity, and for hosting, it's about the same. You know, what's everyone else doing that you could pick up? Chris Berube, who's a producer, I think for 99% Invisible, said, podcasting is a plagiarist medium in that you should steal liberally from everything everyone else has done. That will get you through the hardest parts of it.
The one thing I'll say is that like I feel like there's an opportunity in podcasting to be conversational and to sound like yourself, but I always have everything written. I feel like it's actually really hard to just be like to not be sure of what you're about to say, and it actually requires more energy that you could put towards sounding more conversational if you have a script in front of you. And so I feel like that's something that is just practice, but it's counterintuitive, but I think that really helps me.
I would agree with both of them. The other thing is that you have to understand that as that you evolve and your voice evolves. First of all, your voice is a tool. It is not just this thing you use when the mic goes on. Like, really think about that voice. Take care of it. I always would sing before the current. But seriously, like, it is a tool. Without it, you're not doing a podcast, right? Like, but then listen to other people and hear what you like and don't like and absolutely go, oh, I like what they did there. Gee, what can I think about that? And I've changed, like, even how I did the current is different than how I do more. More is more conversational. Jen Morose is sitting over there. I've been working with her. She's my producer, and she'll go, no, you're reading. No, you're too current. No, you know, we got to do it again. And but it is that kind of thing where she's very nice about it. She's not. But you have to think about what you're saying and who you're saying it to, and you have to work at it that way. And then. Like shift, like my read as a reporter on Parliament Hill was not the same read as a foreign correspondent, as somebody doing a documentary for television, as somebody doing a radio documentary for The Current. It keeps changing because you have to be with what the rest of it is, right? It's part of the story. It's part of how you narrate. It's so, like, really think about that and don't be afraid to change it and keep, like, it's a living thing. So it evolves, and you know it's still a learning thing. Like, and you will hear on more. You'll hear a different tone than you would have heard when I came out of the gate at 8:37 on The Current. It was much faster, and I was on a different mission, you know. So it's that kind of thing. You have to think about how you're talking about it, and really listen to other people and learn from them.
David, if you want to add to it.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is I think it's really useful to make your guests as comfortable as possible in the thing, in terms of getting them to really relax and really feel like they're in the moment and having a conversation with you, creating some sort of comfortable trust environment around your guests before you start the show or before you get into any difficult questions, I think is... you know, allow people to relax and open up more and be more conversational with you. And I mean, I find that my performance depends a lot on the guest performance. Mm-hmm. And if the guest is good and on their game and interesting, I'll be better than if the guest is sort of closed and not talkative very much. So a lot of the secret for me is getting the guest in the right place.
I will say that like I don't think I'm naturally like this. I think I kind of have to really work at it. Like, we know each other, we've known each other for a long time. I think my podcast voice is a little bit different from the way that I normally talk. And as my wife, Emily, who's right there, would know, I just get up in the morning, I'm really anxious about it because I'm like, I'm not sure if I can find my voice. I'm not sure if I can sort of find that groove, that comfortable place that I can be at. And some days it doesn't come until I'm like actually behind the microphone. And I will say, so Jen also developed our podcast, and you worked a lot with me in terms of giving me notes about just like the literal physicality. Like, I sound different when I'm like slightly slouched versus sitting back. That's not a thing that I noticed about myself until we sort of got into this process. I sound most comfortable, weirdly to me, when I'm standing. When I'm standing, I feel like I'm most myself. So I have tried recording some of the podcast standing. It really kind of worked out. It's just like about getting out of your head and getting into yourself. And I think like believing that your most interesting self can come out if you just kind of get out of the way of it. That's my note, really.
Thank you.
Yeah. You had a question? Yes. Maybe the last question, I think. Yep.
Oh, sorry. How's it going, everybody? My name's Dave. Well, first off, I've been with or in the podcasting industry since 2008, so it's really amazing to see this turnout. Mm-hmm. Back in 2008, I was a Canadian podcaster, and nobody knew what the medium was, so it's really awesome. Thank you, panel, for your insight tonight. So, the question. All right, so what podcast show formats do you feel are oversaturated? Like, right off the top of my head, interview-based. So that's one, but what would be your recommendation to revitalize that oversaturated podcast show format? Hmm.
Does anyone who want to do an interview-based podcast want to start on this one? Many of you.
I don't know how to answer that question. It probably is oversaturated, the interview segment, because it's the easiest thing to do. There's no barrier to entry. You just get two mics and sit down and talk to each other. But you know, I think that if there isn't anything special or unique or different about that, it's not going to be successful, and it's just going to be your friends and family that are listening to that podcast. So, I mean, I have to believe that while everybody has a podcast, the ones that are actually offering that kind of value to listeners are going to be rewarded with the listening dial. So again, I think that this is something that listeners are probably sorting out for themselves in terms of the interview format. It's a challenge to make that, every day. Every week when we do an episode, we say to ourselves, how would the CBC do this? And then we do the opposite of that. Not because I hate the CBC, just because there's no point in another one. Like, they've interviewed everybody I'm going to interview. There's no point in replicating that model, right? I got to try to give people something different out of Bob Ray that they've never gotten before, right? And that's the challenge.
I think there's two different answers to that question. One is that I don't know that I feel that we're not yet at a saturation point. I still think the data says there's tons more listeners out there who simply don't know how to get to podcasting. But that means we have cohorts of audiences. So there's like early adopters who are sick and tired of particular formats or particular voices. There's sort of like a middle tier of people who are fans of certain podcasts or certain types of storytelling, and they will follow that regardless of where that goes. And then we're obviously seeing a rise of interest in lots more podcasts, and so we're not yet at a listener saturation point. There are formats I'm particularly done with. I can't listen to two men talking.
I can't do it. Yeah. Can't bring myself to do it. Can't press play. Can't bother with it. Can't handle it. I mean, I started listening to podcasting in 2008.
Yep.
And in 2019, if two men are talking, I just, no.
Right.
Because that's what a lot of the early audience, a lot of the early stories were. And now I'm like, I think I've heard enough of what they have to say. And
what about three men?
Just delete the file and don't press publish. No. It's not for me, right? It's not a place I need to go, and I think that audience is served. So what I'm more interested in is how come there aren't more different people being allowed to use or access those formats to talk about their stories and their communities. That's what's still missing for me. Those are the ones I run to. Two Indigenous women with disabilities talking, hell yeah. They could be talking about the exact same topic, but I think it's far more interesting. And so I didn't answer your question because I have 77 complicated feelings about it.
It's all good, no worries.
But no, I think here's a format that I think I would love to see more of. Short form. People are tired. It's hard
to
figure out everything.
Like 10 minutes? 5 minutes? Like that?
Short 5 to 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, like Planet Money is the indicator, tells me everything I need to know about economics without me ever getting an economics degree, because I won't do that. So 5 to 10 minutes on what a debt spiral is gives me enough to pretend like I'm smart.
But what if you're on the subway, though? You're on the subway. Don't you want that 45-minute podcast? No?
No. I mean, this might just be because I spend all my time like listening really quickly to podcasts, and I'm just sort of at like I'm at my personal saturation point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also do think that, you know, thinking again about where people are, so why people love these home devices that give them 3 to 5 minute pieces of advice or whatever. It's why I think it's terrifying. But like Noom, this sort of new app on health and wellness and weight loss, is popular to people. People are kind of like looking for, you know, short hits of something interesting. And I think it's probably fine to start to think of giving them that.
I'm the exact opposite. If it's 5 minutes, I'm not going to listen. But I don't think there's oversight. I mean, there are how many podcasts are out there now? 850,000, 750,000, something like that, right? So there's oversaturation of everything technically, right? Yeah. I don't think there's oversaturation of conversations. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I pitched more to CBC, because CBC, with the exception of it put its terrestrial interviews on podcasts, but it wasn't offering an interview podcast. And so I wanted to do that. But if you look, and there's certain kinds of interviews, for some reason in the United States, male comedians are the podcasters. I don't understand that, but there's not a lot of journalistic, straight up interviews, that kind of thing. So I don't know if it's oversaturated for that reason. Some people think the crime stuff is, but it really depends on what you're interested in. I mean, are there too many books in the world? Are there too many, you know, like, I don't think there is oversaturation. It just depends on what people want. Sometimes you want an airport read, sometimes you want Shakespeare, and now you can have it in your ears.
Sometimes you want two guys talking.
Not if you're Vicky.
Absolutely never. No.
I know I do a serialized true crime podcast, technically, but I would really be interested in a serialized non-true crime podcast. Like, that I don't actually like listening to true crime. I don't want to, like...
What?
I don't. I feel like there's enough in my work, there's enough exposure to trauma and violence that I really like serialized podcasts. I like diving deep into a story. If it wasn't about a terrible murder or something, like S-Town, I feel like started off being a true crime, but became a much more compelling, interesting story about something else, or like The Dropout, like those kinds of stories that are in-depth, investigative, and serialized.
Do you like Slow Burn?
Well, kind of, but I feel like you know too much of that story for it to be engrossing in the same way that like a story that you just don't know enough about or that you haven't heard in the same way.
Right.
But
I
agree with you about Slow Burn in its first season, because like we kind of already broadly know that story, But then when they
you mean
went
the Watergate one?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, even if
yeah, but did you know about John Mitchell's wife?
Of course.
Do you
not.
Remember
you,
that?
No, definitely.
Story?
Not.
You
definitely
don't
not.
Know everything about
no,
it. But,
I
like,
around,
but it's
I
not
mean,
like you're like, oh, I have to find out what happens next because yeah. we all know what happens at the end.
But the new season that they did on Tupac and Biggie is, you know, like to me, it was like these are a lot of things that I didn't know, even yeah. though I knew sort of the broad.
Like they were 25 or something or 28.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know that.
Yeah. Amazing. I have a sort of obsessive tendencies when it comes to podcasts, which is to say, like, every once in a while I'll gravitate towards one and be like, this is the only one there is. And then, like, a tendency to ignore everything else, which is a very bad habit. I'm trying to break it. But for that reason, I don't have that same kind of contact with the things that that everyone else is kind of getting tired of, you know? Like, I will spend weeks just, like, very slowly, like, 20 minutes here, 30 minutes there, listen to Dolly Parton's America, which mm-hmm. is an incredible podcast. But it's through approaching it this way, like it just kind of just becomes my world through taking like these like little 25-minute journeys into it, right. and they're hour-long episodes. So there's enough to feed me for a while, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Great. Thank you
yes.
so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's invite Natalie Turvey. Come on up.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, we have been treated to a lively and candid and very generous hour of discussion from our panel. On behalf of the CJF and the entire audience, I want to thank you for sharing a masterclass in how to do it well, but also some of the challenges, the village that it takes to create that effortless sounding mm-hmm. podcast. So, and also our deep thanks to Elamine for the work he put into making this a lively and valuable discussion. Please join me in a round of applause for all of our speakers. We are keeping you here for one more minute before, I know the bar is now open, but I do have a brief CJF commercial to share some of our upcoming events because we hope you'll join us. On March 5th, in the lead up to International Women's Day, we'll explore how journalists can increase the gender mix and diversity of news sources and experts they quote in their reporting to better reflect their audiences. And on April 30th, we'll delve into why seeing isn't always believing with a deep dive into deepfake video and how we can prepare for this threat in the disinformation landscape. And the CJF Awards are now open. We have awards for excellence in journalism, lifetime achievement for journalists shedding light on women's equality issues, and valuable fellowships for Indigenous and investigative journalists, and a lot more. So please visit our website and apply. We'll be celebrating those award recipients and honorees for our 30th anniversary gala on June 10th. The award ceremony will be hosted by national comedy icon Rick Mercer, and we'll have the great pleasure of honoring Anna Maria Tremonti with our highest award, the CJF Tribute. For her trailblazing career and the role she's played in shaping the way we all think about current events over the last three decades. So, and finally, our thanks to all of you. You've been a very generous audience as well. Thank you for supporting CJFJ Talks. We'd invite you to stay and to continue the conversation at the cocktail reception and look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks so much. The train is right.